Mother Nature, Mother Nature, she's gonna get you. Yeah, she's gonna get you. Mother Nature, she's grown to hate you. She's gonna get you. Gonna get you, you betcha.
That's almost 52 years so far. The world has become a worse and worse place. Every year we have polluted more water than the year before. Every year there's been less clean air.
Welcome to Nature Blast on the Progressive Radio Network. It's NBL on TRN.FM. This edition of Nature Blast, like future episodes, is pre-recorded. As a result, there's no chance to take your questions on the air. A theme song is provided as a gift with our thanks by Afrozen. You can find more of his work on SoundCloud. And we're going to dive straight into an extended conversation today. There will be no news beyond the echo chamber of the mainstream. We're going to have a conversation with two of my hosts on the current speaking tour. David Petratis joins us from New York City, and I'm here in the dining room of Pauline Schneider. Welcome to Nature Bats Last, Pauline and David.
Thanks, Guy.
Hi, Guy. How are you doing? Hi, David.
Hi, Pauline.
So thanks, David, for joining us. And, you know, I know Pauline. I've spent a little bit of time with her. We haven't even met at this point.
Well, we've Skyped a bit.
Yes, that's right. So I'd like to start with a little bit of your personal history. How did you get to this point? How did you discover my work? What's the reaction from your friends and acquaintances? Do you still have people who will speak to you? That sort of thing. So fill us in a little bit on all things David Petratis.
Okay, good. I think the first thing I've been interested a long time. This is a very roundabout story. Interested a long time in mysticism and Buddhism and Christian mysticism as well. And I got interested in Andrew Harvey's work. And you interviewed him, I think, 3 weeks ago now on Nature Bats Last. And I was going around the internet and I found an interview with him by Carolyn Baker. And they referenced your work. And I said, well, I got to figure out who this person is. So I started Googling you and finding out what you were doing and read the feedback loops. I guess this is about 6 months ago now, 6 or 8 months ago. And it fits in with a lot of what I had been thinking about. In previous professional life, I've worked as a risk manager in reinsurance, which is the insurers who insure really catastrophic losses, and have always been interested in catastrophes and science fiction and things like that. So your summing up of the data was nothing surprising to me. What, of course, was necessary is to take that in and then have it resonate with a particular feeling of acceptance of my life coming to an end, and being able to accept that perspective for not just me, but for everything I love. And that personal step is very, very difficult for many, many, many people who first come in contact with what you're saying, Guy. It's just a fact. People often have to go through a very, very despairing time. Well, I've been living a despairing time for many years. My personal situation is such that I'm caretaking my wife of a few years, who is in terminal phases of ALS. So I am confronted by death in her life every day. And that allows me at least, well, I still get emotional about it, as you hear my voice, mm-hmm. but it allows me at least the perspective of this life is precious because it ends. This life has meaning and needs to be lived uprightly, impeccably, as Carlos Castaneda put it, in view of the fact now not just we come to an end, but we as a species are coming to an end, and we are killing off hundreds of species in ignorance, in absolute blindness every single day. We are, some people call us a yeast or a virus on the surface of this planet, and I don't get angry about that, except upon occasion when I see really rank stupidity. But I'm pretty much in the acceptance phase, but I do go through depressions every once in a while, as everyone does. I go through anger. I don't like the idea of stages, because I think that the grief stages are process cycles, and we move through them fluidly. All the time, and multiple stages in an hour.
Right.
So basically that's me in a nutshell.
Well, that's right. There are stages that we move through, you know, stage one by the time we're 4 years old, and then at 4 years and one day, boom, we're on to the next stage or something like that. I go back and forth myself. I mean, I don't spend all of my time in acceptance. I spend time in anger and depression and bargaining. And I think Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, when she described what had come to be known as her stage, her five stages of grief, I don't think she intended for them to be as discreet as most people perceive them to be.
No,
correct. They were not meant to be milestones that you achieve one stage and then you move on to the next one.
Right. You don't stick there.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right. Right. I mean, it's challenging, and you know better than we do how challenging it is. And you're well acquainted with the concept of anticipatory grief because you've been there for a while.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, you're in a different place than most of us right now because of that anticipatory grief, and because you've been in that position and in a hospice-style environment for a long time.
Yeah.
But I assume you talk about the issues beyond personal as well. You must talk with people in groups small and large about near-term human extinction and maybe even the other species we drive to extinction. What's the reaction, if you do have this conversation, what's the reaction from your friends and acquaintances?
Pretty much passing over it. There are friends that I have who are, and acquaintances who are deeply scientific. So they recognize the data that you put forward, but not many want to engage in a deep discussion of it, and they certainly don't want to go to the place that their emotions are going to be involved in it. And what happens with other people is that when they get it and their emotions become involved in it, then it becomes a very, very difficult thing to communicate, because people, let's face it, we don't, in this culture, learn how to be with people who are dealing with grief.
Right.
We'll throw a box of tissues at them and say, dry your eyes, time heals all wounds, or as you said once, guy, get another. all these solutions, whereas what really, really needed is to just be with the person. And I'm not good at this either, and I know it. I think I was writing to another friend a few days ago and said, you know, there are a couple things I realize that I do which block the empathy. And one is to give a solution, which is, I said, typically men or typically male, because, you know, and typically when your partner comes with a problem, I'm speaking as a male heterosexual now, mm-hmm. and you'll try and offer a solution to the problem rather than just listening mm-hmm. to the feelings that are coming up.
That's very difficult for us.
And the other thing I do, which I realize is misguided empathy, is that I'll offer an experience that I have that's similar, that is meant to say, yeah, I understand the feeling you're going through, and which brings the focus back on me, which is where it shouldn't be, really. It should be on the person who's grieving, the person who's having to deal with painful emotions.
Right.
Through them. So I create another wall between us rather than just sit there and listen and say, yeah, that's really, yeah, that's shitty, you know, that's really bad.
Yeah, haven't you had I'm sure you've had that where you're telling someone your story and they say, oh my God, that reminds me of my story when this and this and that happened, and that was just, I can totally, you know, and then this happened, and then it stops being about your grief. It becomes their story.
Feeling. What happens to your feeling inside mm-hmm. when that occurs? You have to stop feeling the feeling you're inside, mm-hmm. which is already an action against your feeling, and then you have to start listening to the other person and understand what they're feeling.
Yeah.
So you're flipping the whole, you know, I was into my feeling, I was in contact with my feeling, and you were listening to me, which is a very, very good place to be.
Yes.
And the other person flips the switch around. So it's the other way around. Now, that can work really well if you're dancing together in similar place.
Mm-hmm.
So you play the partners of one another in listening. But
right.
It doesn't always occur that way.
Right. Well, you need an agreement
yeah.
on how long you're going to be listening for. You know, what am I listening to? Am I going to listen to you for 3 hours, or do I get the chance to share my story too?
Yeah. But we're really, really poor at listening in this culture. We're quite good at talking and claiming we're communicating,
mm-hmm.
but we're not so swift at listening. You can shut up for a minute. I have something to say.
All right, we've heard enough about this, David. now that's actually what I just did. That's another way of taking you out of your feelings. You
yeah.
know, people crack jokes or try to make light.
The gallows humor is a way to deal with the emotions.
Mm-hmm.
And you can do that as long as you know that you're doing that in order to avoid feeling what you're feeling. But if you want to stay with the feeling and stay with the what's happening, then you have to come back to it.
Exactly.
Right? There is an issue of being, it's hard to listen to someone for a long time. I mean, you've been listening to my voice now for 10 minutes. it's probably too much already.
Oh,
but,
no.
Basically, it's very, very hard to listen. I really respect, you know, non-confronting psychologists who just sit and listen and can do that for 50 minutes with someone.
Right, right.
Yeah, I mean, one, you know, there are various myths associated with grief in this grief-denying culture, and we come up with what are called short-term energy-relieving behaviors to deal with them. And sometimes gallows humor fits into that category. You know, sometimes it's somebody drinking or turning to drugs or becoming obsessive about exercise. I mean, there's all kinds of things we do to release our energy, to change the topic, as it were, away from our grief. And right. Gallows humor sometimes fits into that category, and sometimes it's healthy. It's, to a great extent, these are matters of degree.
Yeah, there is catharsis in humor as well as catharsis in you know, crying out in pain. So the expression of emotion and humor and laughter, of course, is very, very therapeutic.
Yes. Have you, I wanted to ask you, David, with your wife being in, you know, in this, in these final stages, and sometimes they can go for a long time, has that changed your relationship with friends?
Well, when I moved, something I didn't say about my past is between 1975 and 2009, I lived in Europe, and I came back for a job in New York City in 2009, and then met my wife in 2011. Mm-hmm. And basically, I didn't have any real friends in New York City. So my friends, my real good friends, are spread about over the world, you know.
Wow.
Here and there in Europe, and my kids are in Europe. So I have two kids who live in Amsterdam and two kids who live in Switzerland, so.
And you lived in both of those places, right?
I lived 10 years in Amsterdam and 24 years in Switzerland, various places in Switzerland.
Wow. So are those, have those friends that you have left behind there, have they been supportive? Or I know that sometimes when you move that far away, can, you know, it sort of slows those relationships down.
Well, friendship is one of those things. I've mostly had circles of acquaintances through work and professional life.
Mm-hmm.
And I've only had very, very few deep friendships. And those continue to be nurtured online and emails and Skyping and stuff like that. And those are very, very valuable to me. And as I think I said to you the other week, is I'm pretty much a virtual hermit here in New York City. And one of the things I'm trying to do is expand out of my hermitage.
Right.
And we are, you know, going to do a little bit of that at dinner tomorrow, where we're trying to start the face-to-face extinction support group here in New York City. So I will meet for the first time a bunch of NTHEers from New York City tomorrow with you guys, and we'll sit and discuss how we can support one another face-to-face.
That's great.
That's awesome.
That's a new circle of acquaintances for me, which, I mean, you guys know them all too online, and it's something that came to my mind. Particularly, I want to thank Bud Nye for a lot of. Mm-hmm. He runs with a couple other people out in the Seattle area, Tacoma area, actually. Real life extinction support group, not just virtual.
And that's great.
Has done a lot of thinking about what it is to support one another through what is going to be an increasingly bad time.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Right.
And I actually went to one of the meetings of that Tacoma group with Bud Nye several months ago. And his writing on that topic and his thinking on that topic, I think, are leading the way for anybody who wants to follow.
Yeah, my hat's off to him as well. We should interview him next, maybe.
Yes, that's not a bad idea. What about other groups, other outreach kinds of activities to talk about these most important of topics? Are you involved with other folks?
Well, what I do, this was, I realized, I guess, last summer that I was getting a little bit too much cabin fever here. And so in October time frame, and it took me a long time to get this organized, I started reaching out to the local hospital, which had my wife in there for two bouts of care, let's put it that way, just to volunteer. And I'm volunteering for the pastoral care group there. And, you know, so basically getting out and also dealing with people who are very sick and dealing with all sorts of grief that comes from that and listening a lot to them. Absolutely, I'll go in and, you know, if somebody wants to talk, I'll let them talk. And if, you know, somebody doesn't want to talk, well, then I'll just say, you know, we're here, and if you need anything, then give us a call. So there's that. Other than that, I have my wife's family who come by regularly and visit. And I do talk with this about them, but they don't want to really delve into it. They're processing the fact that the eldest daughter of four is leaving a little bit prematurely for the family's taste. So they're processing all that, and I'm having to support that as well as much as I can.
Well, yeah, loss comes in many forms, and as a result, grief comes in many forms. And in this culture, we don't deal well with any of them.
At least 7.25 billion forms, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Something in that neighborhood, that's right.
We had a gathering here last night, David. We started the first part of the grief workshop.
Lovely.
that Guy and I designed based on the grief recovery method. And it was a really nice group of people. But it was so interesting. One of the participants was concerned about the message that Guy has to share about near-term human extinction. He thought that it would upset people to the point where they might lash out back at him.
And in fact, he thought it would spark mass panic. He's worried that the 12 people who listen to me are going to somehow rise up in a revolution. I'm exaggerating only slightly, of course.
Well, no, but he did think that, and he was concerned that Guy might be opening himself up to some sort of blowback in a revolutionary style. I mean, you know, pitchforks and torches coming to the guy's door, you know, why didn't you tell us sooner sort of thing.
And it's pretty interesting. It's interesting because this guy thinks we have 5 years left.
Right.
So he thinks human extinction is very, very imminent, and yet he doesn't really want to spread the word because he's worried somebody's going to cut my head off. He actually mentioned that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I should be so lucky.
Okay.
That somebody finds out the message in at broad enough scale that they come to my door, right?
Right. But it was an interesting thing to bring up at this, you know, at this introductory workshop.
Well, it is true that I want to say a couple things about that. It is true that saying it and getting people to hear it engenders them having to contact an emotion about loss.
Mm-hmm.
And loss at a scale that is stupefying.
Yeah.
At a scale that is stupefying. We are talking about, as Guy and Carolyn so eloquently put it, planetary hospice.
Mm-hmm.
The planet as we have known it as human beings for however many years in prehistory you want to go back, is dying. So that that level of loss, very few people can process without a heavy dose of emotion. That's true.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not true that this has been any secret. Guy interviewed Paul Ehrlich 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
You were last week, so 2 weeks ago, Paul Ehrlich was on. And he's been saying this for 1972 to now, what's that, 43 years?
Yeah,
long time.
43 years at least that scientists have been talking about this. And why someone should pick on a guy, take a machete to is
right.
Right. There's a lot more people who live in the Bay Area, you know, around Stanford, where Paul Ehrlich lives, than live in rural southern New Mexico.
Yeah. No. And you know, there are plenty of other heads to take the, you know, machete to.
Yes.
Even
Al Gore, who has taken a lot of heat for his position. You know.
Yes. Absolutely.
So,
and this guy who was bringing this issue up was just fascinating. He's completely on board. He was devastated by the message. He talked about crying at length, and he went to those things that you just mentioned. It was not him dying. He accepted that a long time ago. It wasn't even so many people that he knows. Everybody he knows dying. It's the notion that all the way back to Galileo and Leonardo da Vinci and the great works of art and the culture, the art,
the music,
everything,
and the literature.
It's devastating.
It's gone.
Well,
yeah.
And if you follow something like Ken Wilber's integral thing, all of the evolutionary advancement that we have made as a human race in consciousness, in ability to understand things, in ability to transcend our past and bring something new into the world, is gone.
Mm-hmm.
It means nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and it always has, right? I mean, our individual lives are short and irrelevant from the cosmic sense, and our entire species is short and irrelevant from a cosmic sense, of course. But
I'm not so sure about that, Guy. I'm not so sure of the cosmic sense. I mean, for me, being a mystically trained person, I'll dispute you on the severe materialism that you
right. Well,
because I believe that consciousness itself is part of the underlying nature of reality and the universe. So we are part of that. We're of it, but we're individual in it.
Right. And try to explain what Beethoven is.
Yeah.
What is Chopin? And those two died at a young age, and Chopin especially, 32. That's their lives, their independent personal lives were short and for all intents and purposes rather insignificant, but for the culture, for the human experience, their lives were incredibly significant and left us a story that moves us. And as, you know, until recently, we thought these stories would move us forever. Their music would be there to move us and motivate us and inspire us. And that's going away. But maybe in some, like you say, maybe in some cosmic sense, it will continue. Because what is music? What is that? What is that sound that is... Those are vibrations.
Vibration in time, yep.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of vibrations, you're listening to the Progressive Radio Network. This is Nature Bats Last on PRN. I'm Guy McPherson, and I'm joined in conversation today by David Petratis and Pauline Schneider as I'm touring Eastern New York State. Thank you for joining us here. David, we haven't even met yet. You know, so you have no idea whether we'll get along in a civil manner. Hosting me is a lot of work. There's events to arrange, and you've done a great job arranging events. There are costs to bear and so on. So why bother? I mean, you have lots to do. You could just be a hermit in New York City, which is a hard enough task all by itself.
maybe, Guy, it's because I feel that sense of connection with you that perhaps you could be a good friend.
Well, that's quite a compliment. Thank you.
It's a big aw.
Yeah.
That is very sweet. We're actually going to see David. We're going to see you in just a couple hours from now.
Before this airs, I will be at the Spoonbill Book.
That's right.
We need to advertise that one as well, so...
Yes.
Right. Yes.
Spoonbill Books in Brooklyn.
When we get to about this point in the episode, you'll need to start preparing your computer to tap into the live stream, which will be broadcast from Spoonbill Books. There'll be a little book reading and book signing event, and Pauline is going to film it and put it out on live stream.
Well, actually, that would be... earlier, 7, because that event starts at 7, so
yeah.
I'll probably be live streaming around 7:30.
Right, yeah, I can't keep track of...
And the radio show goes on at what time?
At 8. Oh, yeah. My apologies, I have it all turned around.
So by the time everyone hears this show, you will be old and fast friends with David.
That's right.
And we will have been live streaming.
The advertisements that come after the events are particularly embarrassing, aren't they? You never see that on the Super Bowl.
Exactly.
You should have caught this show last night. They never do that on Super Bowl.
No, they never do.
Oh, here we are. Hilarity abounds
on
the amateur hour.
The trials and tribulations of time travel.
Exactly.
Speaking of time travel, we were in Rhode Island. I participated in a panel discussion at Rhode Island. That event was live streamed, and you can catch it online still.
Now time for the big reveal. Back to L.A. and Lara.
There you go, Lara.
Wow.
I think that was a little feedback from space.
Some time travel there. Dr.
Holy cow. That was a little weird. I was at a conference once, and one of the funniest people I've ever met was delivering a presentation, and a voice came over the intercom system in the middle of his presentation and said something like, "Is this working?" And he didn't even bat an eye. He looked up at the ceiling and he says, "God, is that you?"
<That's>
He was just
wonderful.
So quick. It was unbelievable.
I love those electronic acts of God.
Yes.
They're so much fun.
Could I ask you, Pauline, perhaps, to give us a little bit more foretaste of this grief workshop? Because you and Guy are also going to be doing that this coming Friday night and Saturday.
Yes.
In New York City. And I want to give a plug for that.
Right. Friday, we will be at in the Chinatown part of the city.
Perfect.
And we have a Guy will be giving a presentation. And after the presentation will be the first part of the workshop, and that's Friday night, which we will then continue Saturday morning around 10:30 until about 4:30, if all things work out.
And we're really trying not to focus on grief per se. The mere mention of the word turns people away. And really, we're trying to focus on the reality of the situation. So, I've done a couple of iterations of this thing before on the West Coast, and people come up and say, there was grief in the description of this thing, so 5 of my friends didn't come, and I was reluctant. That's how deep our denial of grief and grieving is in this culture. Mm-hmm. And so we're really trying to make this workshop about acceptance of reality. In fact, a working title for the workshop was the Climate Reality Acceptance Process. And we never use the acronym for Climate Reality Acceptance Process.
For obvious reasons.
Yes. And now we're calling it Abrupt Climate Change, How Will You Show Up During Humanity's Final Chapter? Because it's really about what we do, given that our lives are short, and that our lives have always been short, no matter how long we live. How do we show up? What do we do? What do we do with our limited time here? How do we pursue our own version of excellence? What do we view as successful? Those are the kinds of topics that we want people to engage with. And focusing on grief seems to get in the way.
And if you want to find out the details of this, you can go to Guy's website, to his coming events page.
That's GuyMcPherson.com, to the coming events page, the little tab up there at the top left.
But specifically, so, I mean, Friday it will be at Project Reach, 39 Eldridge Street, Suite 4 in New York City.
And that presentation part on Friday is open to the public. And after that, we will start the workshop, but people have not committed to the workshop at that point. So we're going to start at 6 p.m. this Friday night, hosted by Deep Green Resistance at Project Reach, 39 Eldridge Street. Come up to Suite 4, listen to the presentation. If you find it engaging and interesting, then ask if you can hang around for the workshop to follow. And if not, we'll all understand.
Absolutely. And it's free. It's free.
Well, enjoy some Chinese food.
Right, Chinese food, exactly. Now, and I just wanted to mention that it's a free event. Usually workshops like this, people charge hundreds of dollars for them. But we are in hospice, and we really believe that this is critical for people to have access to these tools. And not only just access to the tools, but access to other people who get it, so that you can meet people face-to-face and create new friendships, new support groups. Because we've all had the experience where you're in a family, or you have a friend, or your spouse, or your partner don't get it, and you can't talk to them about this. And so you need to go outside of that circle of friends and meet new people who do get it and create new circles. And that's one of the other benefits of doing these events. All we ask for is, if this served you in some way and you found it beneficial, to leave us a small donation to help, fund our car, gas, train rides, food, and all that other stuff.
Right. I've been operating on a gift economy for a long time. And if people want this work to continue, that's the best way to make it happen, is mm-hmm. to make some sort of contribution. We usually on the radio show toward the end, we have what we call the Doomer of the Week. And I want to take a short break here and acknowledge the efforts of a guy named Herb, who goes by the name Benjamin the Donkey online. Mm-hmm. Benjamin the Donkey is the most amazing writer of limericks I've ever come across. He just cranks them out, I think, every 30 seconds or so when he's awake. It's really pretty impressive. And so this limerick is called Avoidance. He wrote it just this morning. Maybe the main reason why we argue, talk nonsense, and lie is because that for real we'll most likely feel increasingly worse till we die. Oh, he's just amazing. I met Benjamin, right, whose actual name is Herb, at an event in Hayward, California several months ago. My volunteer manager, Peter Melton, asked me to ease the audience into the message. So Peter is always telling me, you need to go slow. Tell them that the Al Gore movie said we need to change the light bulbs, and then the IPCC says the temperature rise is going to be 1.8 or maybe up to 4.5 degrees centigrade by the end of the century, but it's all about you know, a long time into the future. And so Peter's is encouraging me to ease the people into this. And so I'm up for that. That's fine. He knows the audience better than I do. So I'm all ready to ease them into it. And then I see Benjamin the Donkey in the crowd before it starts. So I go up to him and ask him, hey, would you mind writing a limerick and sort of kick this thing off informally with your limerick? He says, oh, he acted a little nervous. He said, yeah, I'll work on that. And so 3 minutes later, he had a limerick. And I don't remember exactly how it goes, but the message was, you're going to die very, very soon. And so he read that to kick the thing off. And I looked at Peter, and Peter looked at me, and I shook my head, and I said, there goes the easy entry, Peter. What we have here is failure to communicate.
Wow, but I'm sure it was a great way to start that.
And sometimes he writes, you know, limericks that go on for five stanzas or so, and they're all connected. Really nice, yeah.
Yeah, he's a pretty incredible guy. He's in his early 70s and just obviously very sharp, and I can't believe how good he is at writing these conventional lyrics, always with the correct number of syllables and the rhyme in the perfect place.
Yeah. Well, he's had plenty of practice.
I wonder if he's an Irishman, just thinking about it.
Well,
could be.
I don't know. And not judging from his last name, which I'll not reveal since I didn't ask his permission. But I want to bring us a little up to date on the panel discussion that we had in Rhode Island. And maybe Pauline can talk a little bit about that. And as I indicated, it's available on live stream. And it brought out the skeptics, as is often the case, not the skeptics of anthropogenic climate change, but the skeptics of abrupt climate change, who continue to deny that human extinction will occur in the near term, while promoting to a great extent the civilization that's driving us to extinction. So I think that's sort of ironic, or as I might otherwise say, hilarity abounds.
Well, it's the search for the techno-fantasy fix. Science got us into this mess. Well, of course it can get us out as well. I mean, it's so clever.
All we need to do is build more nuclear plants. That'll solve it.
Yes, there was mention of that.
Yes, the James Hansen approach.
He's not alone. He's not alone.
No, absolutely not. And the thorium idea came out as well.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Fortunately, there was a physicist on the panel, and he pointed out that even though he doesn't know a heck of a lot about thorium, he can't imagine we'd get that online anytime within the next quarter century or so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He said because of the adoption rate of a new technology, it takes 25 years to go from a theory to a working technology.
Correct.
Right. Yes. Obviously, you were paying closer attention to the other panelists than I was, David. Thanks for that.
Well, I could sit at home and be undistracted by 100 people in the room.
I can't. When they really went down the road, the other panelists went down the road of, oh my God, you're really going there. I can't believe you're saying that out loud. I wanted to drag out my phone and check my email message. I managed to refrain.
He resisted.
Well, plus, you know that where you were in Rhode Island sits just miles from Millstone, and it is at sea level.
Right.
It is at its cooling water comes out of Long Island Sound. Mm. So, abrupt sea level rise will probably take out their generators.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to be inconvenient.
Yes.
For a lot of people in that area of Rhode Island.
Well, maybe they could put it up on stilts.
Oh, yeah.
You think that'll work?
Oh, speaking of techno fantasy solutions, Polly, thanks for bringing one to the fore here.
Yeah, well, you know, I like coming up with all kinds of solutions. I'm your solution gal.
Yeah, right.
There isn't a problem I can make worse with the solution.
or as I used to say when I was teaching in classrooms for many years, for every solution, there are numerous problems.
You have to excuse me for about 30 seconds.
Sure, no
okay.
problem.
We'll carry on without you.
We're quite good at that.
So we are scheduled to go into the city today and to Spoonbill Books. That'll be ancient history by the time you're listening to this recording. Pauline, why don't you fill us in on what's next? Because I don't keep very close track.
Well, Sunday, this coming Sunday, there's an event at Woodbine, and that is,
That's the Woodbine Collective.
Right.
I think it's in Queens.
Yes, and the address for that is 18-84 Woodbine Street.
In the city.
In the city.
New York
in
City.
Queens.
And I'm really looking forward to that event. That's from 6 to 8 p.m. this coming Sunday, March 1st. And I'm going to share the floor with Roy Scranton, who wrote an article in the New York Times titled Learning How to Die in the Anthropocene. And so he's been thinking about this for a while. I think that came out several months ago. And apparently Scranton is working on a book about the topic of the Anthropocene and the human response. Mm-hmm. So this is one of the more legitimate public figures who's actually agreed to be seen with me in public. So that's pretty exciting.
Well, it's great because he's talking about extinction and how to do it. And, you know, that sounds really ironic. How do you die? But there's a way to do it.
How do you show up?
Yes. Right. And it's always been about how we show up and what we do and how we behave. But the notion that we don't have as long as we thought we did brings some urgency to that message and to that understanding, I think.
True. Well, I thought it was interesting at the forum the other night when the oceanographer said that we're not in a major extinction.
Right.
But I was fairly, I don't know, I thought we were in the sixth great extinction.
We are in the midst of the sixth great extinction. There's denial on every front.
So even an oceanographer can't accept that because he said that you need a loss of 50% of species,
mm-hmm.
correct? Now, we've been in this extinction for a few thousand years, and it's escalating at a speed much faster than when the dinosaurs went extinct. It took something like 80,000 years for the dinosaurs to go extinct.
Yeah, but we're number one.
One of my very good acquaintances that I knew for years in Switzerland is a biologist who heads up the Red Book list of endangered species, International Union for the Conservation of Nature. And he's based now, I think, somewhere in England, Oxford or Cambridge. Oxford, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, you know, they are cataloging the ones that already have names. Let's face it, we don't even know all the species that live in our biosphere.
Oh, right.
That's right. We probably don't know it within an order of magnitude.
Yeah.
And so
without knowing them.
Right. And so the extinction rate, obviously, is an estimate. And it's based on the number of species we've identified and how many species they impact. And so there's this well-accepted notion that when a species goes extinct, depending on the species, it takes out other species with it along the way. So that's why the estimate is somewhere between 150 and 200 species a day going to extinction. We don't know whether it's 172 on average or 191.
Yeah.
Well,
the error bars are rather large.
Yes.
Right.
No matter how you look at it, the sixth great extinction is proceeding more rapidly than any of the previous five.
Sure sucks for those species, though.
Yeah.
Whether it's a lower number or a higher number.
Well, yeah.
No, like Beethoven, they're gone forever.
Right, forever is a long time, especially toward the end.
You know, there is that anticipatory grief which many of the people that are acquaintances of mine in the virtual sphere have for other species. You know, the sadness, I mean, we see it every day in the news that we read, the sadness for, like, sea lions, or the sadness for fish, sadness for...
Monarch butterfly.
Monarch butterfly. There's a species that is tied to one species of plant, which we are destroying, milkweed. When the milkweed goes, there will be no more monarchs. It's going rapidly. Some people are trying to plant it so that the monarchs can stay around. But.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's another thing. You know, I'm a gardener and a landscape designer, and, you know, when my clients ask me what they should plant, I always encourage them to plant species that support the ecosystem. And a good friend of mine, Michelle Durivage, and I had the idea to create a project wherein communities would turn their lawns into edible gardens. And edible not just for humans, but for bees, birds, and butterflies. The three B's, if I may. And I have to say, it was very difficult to convince people to do that. They really are attached to their mini golf courses. but I really, really encourage people to turn your lawn over to nature. Restore your lawn. Have a no-mow lawn and plant it, interplant it with flowers that feed monarchs, that feed butterflies, that feed honeybees and native bees. There are nectaries. There are wasps and flies that survive on nectar only, and we need to feed them to keep the healthy ecosystem. Now, I know this is all moot in the larger scale of this massive extinction that's coming on, but in the interim, there are things we can do, yeah. And it makes you do what you love. It makes your world, your space, a little more beautiful. And it's how you can gracefully exit.
Well, and another thing, and I get this from Derek Jensen when I speak with him, we know if we drive to extinction a species, say the monarch butterfly, if there are no monarch butterflies next week, there will never be monarch butterflies again. But if there are monarch butterflies next week, there might be monarch butterflies another year, another decade, another century. We don't know with certainty what the future holds. So let's try to keep as many cards in the deck as we can.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, dragonflies are 400 billion years old. 400 million, sorry.
My mouth had a little accident. Everything's a bazillion years old on the planet.
We don't do well with words that end with illion, I'm afraid.
Illions, just illions.
Illions and illions of stars.
Oodles and oodles. Yes. But that's think of dragonflies and how, you know, they have survived this long.
Yeah. Crocodiles. That was another one that I, you know.
Right.
Yes.
Right. There are still a few species we haven't driven to the brink yet.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're working on it.
Well, you know, with the rains in, I was just reading about this, the rains in Southeast Asia, they're being very careful, and in Northern Australia with the two typhoons cyclones that hit them there. Mm-hmm. They're being very careful because they're saying that crocs are coming inland to places that they don't normally come.
Oh my gosh.
Well, yeah, that's a classic example of altering the habitat.
Yep.
You know, we're clever organisms, so we think the notion of habitat doesn't apply to us, but it applies to all other organisms on the planet. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking we might not be as special as we suspect we are.
Right. No, we're not. We're definitely not special.
We're special, like yeast and other species.
Exactly.
You're unique, just like everyone else.
Well, David, we've just about run out of time.
See that.
Wanted to thank you so much for joining us. And it's been a lot of fun doing this. This is really great.
I look forward to this evening.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you, David. I very much appreciate the opportunity to chat with you. And I look forward to meeting you in a couple of hours before this show even goes on the air.
Yes.
Time travelers again. Yes. Thank you very much for having me on the show.
Thank you.
Thanks, David. That's our show for today, for tonight. Please make sure to like our Facebook page, Nature Bats Last, on the Progressive Radio Network, and join our Facebook group as well. It's Nature Bats Last on PRN.fm. Feel free to post questions you'd like us to address on the show. Please continue to follow Guy's blog, GuyMcPherson.com, for further updates, essays, and speaking tours.
And on the topic of speaking tours, there's a website dedicated to the European tour, GuyMcPherson.net.
So join us next week with Guy and me.
And Frank Coughlin, hopefully, he can tear himself away from the Deep Green Resistance crowd.
That would be fantastic. And thanks again to all the excellent contributions and our amazing engineer at PRN and Afrizen for the music. Until next time, remember, the dominant culture has been very clever, but in the end,
nature bats last.
Gonna get you.